It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. The topic for today is the fourth and my favorite paramita, joyful effort. But what in the world really is that? What is that? In Japan, a Zen person is sometimes described as a vigorously jumping fish. And the Japanese word for that is kappa tsupatsu, which is onomatopoetic for the sound of a fish joyfully jumping and splashing in the water. So indeed, regarding the attributes of virya, which means vitality, the virya paramita, Zen people, like vigorously jumping fish, can't seem to settle on just one or two of the attributes. As we go over them, count the ones you see in yourself. And at the end, I'll give you a little chart just for fun, for you to translate that number into something meaningful. So in no special order, here are the 12 attributes of the paramita of joyful effort, or virya, the 12 attributes that this paramita is thought of as containing. There's many more. I'm just picking 12. And the first one is passionate enthusiasm. Whatever a bodhisattva, which is you, whatever a bodhisattva does, she does with passionate enthusiasm. Why? Because she loves saving beings from suffering. So there is joyful effort in maintaining joyful effort. There's joyful effort in maintaining joyful effort. When first starting out on the Dharma path, there's often a lot of enthusiasm, but after a while, one tends to get stale and just go through the motions, but not to let it. Just like in love, it's important to create and renew one's intentions and feelings constantly, almost as a practice in itself. So the second attribute that I'm naming is bodhicitta. And bodhicitta means bodhi mind, the thought of awakening that arises not from ourselves, not from others, not from itself, but from the communion of Buddha and sentient beings. So bodhi mind arises in the world through the call and response of sentient beings and Buddhas, which all boils down to meaning, you need to ask for what you want. These great beings are there just to give you what you want or help you have what you want. But you have to ask. As soon as you ask, you'll get a response. It's immediate. There's actually four kinds of spiritual asking. I'll just tell you about this. The first is you ask, but you don't perceive yourself asking, and you don't receive a response, but you don't perceive that you've received a response. So it's all happening, but you're not aware of it. And the second is you know you're asking, but you don't know you're getting a response. And the third is you don't know you're asking, but you do feel somehow answers are coming to you. And the fourth is you know you're asking and you actually receive a response. The thought, Bodhi mind, the thought of awakening arises in any of these four, but it needs to be cared for and protected by affirming our aspiration for awakening vigorously. The third quality of joyful effort is consistency. So commitment to these practices, that is the six paramitas, requires a consistent and steady routine that's sustainable over time. Reflecting on our aspiration, awakening over and over, once a day or twice a day is not too much. And consider this story of a wonderful Zen master named Zwiegen. This is a little story about Zwiegen. Every morning, Zwiegen called out to himself, "Master." Then he would answer, "Yes, sir. Are you awake?" And again, he would answer, "Yes, sir. Yes, sir." "Now all day long, do not be deceived by others." "I won't. I won't." So he said every morning, that's what Zwiegen did. And I think it's terrific. It's a great way. And the next one is joy. Bodhisattvas practice the first three, generosity, ethics, and patience, for the welfare and liberation of others. We are joyful when we practice. We are not trying to get joy through our practice. Our practice is joy. The fifth one is rest. For example, when we are fatigued, to rest is appropriate. While sometimes it's easier to continue doing something rather than stop, that is a form of laziness. It's just easier to continue so you don't stop, but actually you need to rest. You need to rest and you should and must stop. Overwork is a form of laziness. Taking on things that are too advanced is a form of laziness. Not stopping when you've done enough is another form of laziness. Taking on practices that we might have quit, that we might quit halfway through, we already know, is another. It's our responsibility as well as delight to rest when needed and take good care of our practice. We need to discern. We need to discern. We need to know what we're doing and know ourselves and whether what we're doing in the quantity and intensity of what we're doing is appropriate for us. The sixth one is heroic effort. This word heroic is often used along with these paramitas because, as you probably remember, a paramita is a transcendent behavior. It's a transcendent action. And what is it transcendent of? Itself. It transcends itself. And it's called heroic. It heroically transcends itself. But one of the reasons that bodhisattva effort is called heroic is because we foolishly enter into it wholeheartedly even though we don't fully understand what we're getting ourselves into. Bodhisattvas vow and enter the wisdom of the Buddhas to help other beings enter the wisdom of the Buddhas. Bodhisattvas don't necessarily think their actions are helpful, but they definitely want their actions to be helpful. Our process towards perfect wisdom begins with our aspirations to carry all beings beyond suffering into a life of peace and freedom. When we commit to this aspiration, it becomes a vow, and later the vow and the development of wisdom develops into perfect wisdom. So like a fool, we jump in. We trust our aspiration, but it's more than trust. We intuitively know that we're doing the right thing. The seventh one is perseverance. We never give up. We are always moving forward on the bodhisattva path, but it may not look that way to us. To be great practitioners, we have to keep returning to our original aspiration in order to sustain our enthusiasm to become heroes of enlightenment. But Eiken Roshi puts this beautifully. He says, the human being by nature is inadequate, practices Zazen inadequately, and realizes true nature inadequately. This is the Virya Paramita. On and on we persevere, like a small child determined to learn how to walk while continually falling over, or like a very old person getting up in the middle of the night, lurching from wall to wall to reach the bathroom. I think that's a terrific way of describing the perseverance of joyful effort. This is the subject we're talking about, joyful effort. And what are the attributes? And that one was perseverance. And another is distraction control. On his great realization, the Buddha exclaimed, "All beings are the Tathagata. Only their delusions and preoccupations keep them from testifying to that fact." Rid yourself of delusions and preoccupations and distractions, and you've got it, Eiken Roshi affirms. You have a hard time with this because your nature is the same as Buddha's. He had to practice hard too. Don't give up. And Eiken Roshi also says, I think this is really interesting because I found it so myself. Circumstances are like your arms and legs. They appear in your life to serve your practice. As you become more and more settled in your purpose, your circumstances begin to synchronize with your concerns. I think this is very true. And it's kind of amazing to suddenly feel circumstances beginning to synchronize with my concerns. And the ninth one, and there were 12, we're on nine, is thoroughgoing. Dogen says that when one is not full of the Dharma, one feels that it is complete. When one is full of the Dharma, something seems to be missing. And Eiken Roshi comments, when you think you are complete, there is something lacking in your body and mind. When you know there is something missing, you are complete. And that's an awareness of not yet, not enough yet. So thoroughgoing is moment by moment discovering not enough. Why? Because we have a big job to do. And then 10 is sincerity. What is it that underlies everything? Is a basic Zen question. And it's always on a bodhisattva's mind. The 11th one is single-minded zeal. There is delight in our work. Large scale, fearless, single-minded zeal. And finally, the last one on my list, I'm sure there's like double the amount, is laziness. Laziness is our biggest obstacle. So the last one is exertion, and the opposite of that, laziness, is our biggest obstacle. And it disappears in the face of joyful effort. Usually, laziness is related to not having one's life organized properly around one's ultimate purpose. But with exertion, one makes a good schedule, wakes up on time, finds time to practice, study the Dharma, and attend to one's work. Exertion means, first, knowing one's ultimate purpose, awakening, and from there, good scheduling and good organization of one's life will naturally follow. The practice of Dharma gets into one's blood, such that one regards exertion as a part of one's basic natural activity, rather than something imposed from the outside. It does feel that way, that exertion is just the ordinary way one does something. Or else why do it, really? Okay, so you've been counting the ones that you feel you do, that you do those things. You live your life in that way. And so here's what I want to say. If you got 10 or more, you've already succeeded, and hey, you're on the path. Very good. And if you have between 5 and 10, you've already succeeded, but you aren't quite sure you're on the path. And 5 or fewer, you've already succeeded, but you're not aware of the path at all. The reason you have already succeeded is that you're on the path. You're here. That in itself is an amazing success. Truly. I mean, in the big picture, it's an amazing success. From here, everything that happens to you is part of your work on the path. It becomes your spiritual practice, and you take care of it from a place of practice, which is much more intelligent, aware, and inclusive of your whole life than someone without a practice. I mean, there are people who don't even know what a practice is or never even heard of it. So again, laziness, as I've mentioned, is the main obstacle to joyful effort. And usually it shows up in 3 ways. The first way is just ordinary laziness. We keep falling asleep and we're unable to get ourselves together. We've not organized our life properly around our ultimate purpose. And we begin to feel that we are victims of our lives rather than victims of our own laziness. So that's the first of the three kinds of laziness. And the second is losing heart. We say, how is it possible for someone like me to attain enlightenment? It's impossible. I shouldn't even try. In fact, what's the point of trying to do anything? It is said that we lose heart because we like samsara so much. We don't want to give up our treasures. So we don't want to get involved in getting beyond birth and death, which is what enlightenment is. The third one is called preoccupied laziness. This is the laziness of being preoccupied with activities other than dharmic ones and exerting ourselves in those situations instead of devoting ourselves to dharma practice. In truth, we couldn't care less about the dharma. This type of laziness is the most dangerous because we're actually using our life to avoid practice. We feel extraordinarily energetic when we exert ourselves in other things, but when it comes to sitting, we're very lazy. We'd rather vacuum the floor. The antidote to laziness is first compassion. We must have compassion for ourselves when we see that we're lazy. That's the very first thing. We have to have self-compassion. And second, we try to understand it, get to the heart of it, address the heart, which is knowing our ultimate purpose in life instead of laziness, the symptom. So we address the heart of the problem, which is knowing our heart. The heart of the problem is that we don't know our ultimate purpose. And so when it comes to dharma, it's like, so what, kind of. And that creates the laziness. And so thirdly, we need to cultivate a sense of urgency around the dharma. Practice itself with a no matter what attitude is the key. So here is a story of one of the Buddha's 10 greatest disciples. Imagine that, to be the Buddha. He had millions of disciples, to be one of the 10. Purna is his name. And Purna, I think I've told you, each one of the 10 were foremost in something. And Purna, P-U-R-N-A, was foremost in teaching the Dharma. He's an inspiring example of the no matter what joyful effort. He had that no matter what attitude with great joyful effort. But as you will see, he was a fully enlightened being. And this story that I'm going to read to you is by a contemporary Chinese Zen master. Among the Buddha's disciples, this is by the Chinese Zen master I'm reading to you. Among the Buddha's disciples, there were those who were wonderful speakers of deep faith and majestic in bearing. These speakers traveled from place to place to help spread the Buddha's teachings. Among these highly regarded disciples, Purna was known as foremost in teaching the Dharma. Not only was he eloquent of tongue and deep of faith, Purna had the spirit of a true teacher. In one case, after Honorable Purna, honorable is an acknowledgement of his wisdom, being one with ultimate truth. What anybody who attains enlightenment in the Buddhist community was known as Honorable whoever. So Honorable Purna, listened. He listened. So this is the Buddha was speaking. He listened to the Buddha speak, and he waited until everyone had gone before approaching the Buddha. After kneeling and paying his respects, Purna said, "Buddha, as your disciples, we have you as our teacher. We rely on the true Dharma. This is truly a most fortuitous opportunity, our highest honor. I believe that everyone seeks refuge in the Buddha, not for the sake of food and clothing, not for the sake of joining the Buddhist community and finding a place of sanctuary, but for the sake of cultivating the wisdom, spreading the true Dharma of the Buddha in the world and benefiting all beings. This is our aspiration. Now I beg the Buddha, in his compassion, to allow me to go to the kingdom of Suna Paranta to spread the teachings there." When the Buddha heard Purna's words, he grew very happy. But the great teacher, the Buddha, knew the difficulties of spreading the Dharma. He knew about that, and said earnestly to Purna, "Purna, teaching sentient beings, benefiting oneself and others, and spreading the true Dharma, these are all worthy aspirations. However, you do not necessarily have to travel to Suna Paranta to teach. It would be better if you chose a different place. You should start your travels tomorrow. We will happily see you off." Not understanding his meaning, Purna gazed questioningly at the Buddha's benevolent countenance and said, "Buddha, I do not understand. Is not any location where people reside a good place to spread the Dharma? Now that I have aspired to go to Suna Paranta, a place where the teachings have yet to be heard, why do you ask that I choose another destination?" The Buddha explained, "Purna, the kingdom of Suna Paranta is a small and desolate place. Due to the difficulty of traveling there, the culture there has not developed. The people there are violent and ruthless, while fighting and berating others is commonplace. Often, outsiders meet their death there. Are you not afraid to go there to teach?" After hearing the Buddha's concern, Purna smiled, yet remained resolute, saying, "Buddha, you care for your disciples so compassionately that we find it difficult to express our gratitude. In order to repay your kindness, I would be willing to offer up what insignificant little I have to the Buddha, to the Dharma, and to all living beings. It is precisely because Suna Paranta is such a barbarous place and no one else dares to set foot there that I must propagate the Dharma there. Once there, I am aware that all manners of danger await me, but for the sake of propagating the true Dharma, such trifling matters as my own safety are not worth considering. May the Buddha's light shine upon me and allow me to go and found a pure land on earth." The Buddha's face radiated benevolent light. He was both moved by and delighted by Purna's willingness to sacrifice himself for the Dharma. And yet the Buddha still wished to test the strength of Purna's will. He turned to Purna and asked in a familiar manner, "Purna, the words you have spoken are not wrong in the least. As disciples of the Buddha, the two activities of teaching and practice are of utmost importance. However, if the people of Suna Paranta do not accept your teaching, but curse you and scold you instead, how would you feel?" Without hesitation, Purna replied, If they curse me, I will think of them as good people. They are not barbarians, for they limit themselves to yelling rather than beating me. What if they use fists, stones, or clubs to beat you? The Buddha said. I will still think of them to be good people, Purna replied, for then they use only fists, stones, and clubs to beat me, but cannot bear to take swords and stab me. And what if they use swords to stab you? I will still think of them to be good people, for they still have their humanity and do not go so far as to kill me. And what if they kill you? The Buddha inquired. Then I will be indebted to them, for they have killed my impermanent body, helping me enter nirvana. They would have helped me to use my life to repay the kindness of the Buddha. Although, this is the sentence, although this would not be a great hindrance to me, it is regrettable that this would not be of any benefit to them. Although this would not be a great hindrance to me, it is regrettable that it would not be of any benefit to them. It would not be a great hindrance to him, because with death, he knows he goes nowhere but to the source. Everything is interconnected. Filled with joy, the Buddha praised Purna. You have shown yourself to be a true disciple. You were able to keep your peace in practice, teaching, and patience. Beings who wish to be disciples of the Buddha, filling the duties of teaching and benefiting others, must bear spirits like yours. After hearing the Buddha's wise words and encouragement, Purna was deeply moved and inspired. He resolved to spread the Dharma. His resolve was stronger than ever. And after paying his respects to the Buddha, he began his journey to Sunaparanta amidst the cheers of many bhikkhus that gathered to see him off. And not long thereafter, Purna gathered together more than 500 disciples and built 500 monasteries in Sunaparanta. His reputation as the foremost teacher of the Dharma in the monastic community began to spread. Finally, the Honorable Purna became a famous teacher of the Dharma, bringing joy to the Buddha and receiving his praise. Here are some of the most important points from today's talk. First, just like in love, it's important to create and renew our practice constantly, almost as a practice in itself. So there's joyful effort, maintaining joyful effort. We renew our practice of joyful effort with joyful effort. Second, we jump in like a vigorously jumping fish, joyfully jumping and splashing in the water. This means with everything we do. Third, bodhicitta means bodhi mind, the thought of awakening that arises, not from ourselves, not from others, not from itself, but from the communion of Buddha and sentient beings. That's how Bodhi mind arises. Bodhi mind arises in the world through the call and response of sentient beings and Buddha. So that means the great beings are there. They're there for us. That's their job, to ask for hearing us ask for help. But we have to ask. That's how it works. They're there, ready, awake and ready, but we have to ask. And then fourth, this wonderful poem by Zwiegen. Every morning, Zwiegen called out to the master himself, "Master!" Then he would answer, "Yes, sir. Are you awake?" And again, he would answer, "Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Now all day long, do not be deceived by others. I won't. I won't." And the fifth one, main important point, bodhisattvas don't necessarily think their actions are helpful, but they definitely want their actions to be helpful. And lastly, as you become more and more settled in your purpose, your circumstances begin to synchronize really with your purpose. It means you will feel more and more how the universe is in alignment with you. And here are some ideas for reflection during the week. And I want to announce that these questions for reflection are now going to be posted on the website when the video is posted. So they'll be posted together. So in order to integrate these teachings, reflecting on even one of these questions during the week will be extremely useful. And so I'm going to make them easily available to you. You'll have heard the talk, and then as soon as the talk is posted, you can remind yourself of these questions. So here are five questions for reflection. The first, a joyful effort requires first knowing one's ultimate purpose, and from there, good scheduling and good organization of one's life. Within these three necessities, where do you succeed and where do you falter? In the ones where you falter, might you request help? And the second one. So we Zen people are supposed to be like a fish joyfully jumping and splashing in the water internally. Internally, right, internally. In what areas of your life, either now or in the past, have you sounded like this? Might you study this sound so as to fully understand and ultimately include it in everything you do? Third, which kind of laziness do you relate to most? Of those three kinds of laziness, which do you relate to most? Can you write a history of it? When did it begin? Under what circumstances? How did you deal with it? How are you dealing with it now? Analyze it as if you were a doctor. And if you can't remember the three, just forget it. Laziness, or go for ordinary laziness. One was disheartening and one was preoccupied. And then the fourth, Marie, in her famous book on tidying, tells us to throw all of our t-shirts, say, in a pile in the living room and pick them up one by one. And if it gives you joy, you should keep it. And if it doesn't, which you will know instantaneously, you should throw it away. So give your life the joy test. Do that with your life. Which parts bring you joy and which parts don't? Try to make everything in your life pass the joy test. Otherwise, toss, throw it out. And fifth, Exertion or joyful effort is a critical quality. Can you learn from yourself, noticing when it arises, the aspects of those circumstances? Who is around? What are you doing? How knowledgeable are you about what you were doing? Can you learn about this critical quality of joyful effort from yourself? And all those things, get a PhD in the joy in your life. Know everything there is to know about it. That's the fifth reflection to ponder this week in order to integrate these teachings more fully. And again, they'll be posted on the website. I wonder if you have questions.
Thank you, Gail. So the first question that we have is, my score on the joyful effort test was 5 or fewer. I hardly ever feel joy, and I certainly don't have those hardcore qualities that make joyful effort a part of the things I do. I spend a lot of time wasting time, which is really avoiding my life. No matter what I do to get out of this, it doesn't last. It feels kind of hopeless.
There's a famous Roshi who was severely criticized in his life for wasting his whole life doing zazen. That's sort of a free association, but it's not a bad idea. This same Roshi has many disciples, but he refuses to take any responsibility for them. I will be your teacher, but your life is yours and you are responsible for your life. He doesn't even monitor the frequency of their zazen. It's like, I'll be your teacher. Your life is yours. You're responsible for it. Do it, I hope. But because their life is their life, they can't lean on him is the point. They have to do their life themselves. And sometimes inertia, which is what you're talking about, is such a habit that we can't yank ourselves out of it, but we must. So first, have great compassion for this inertia and study it until you're an expert, you know all about it, and then apply exertion with a no matter what attitude. Be strict. Actually, you can do it, but you have to set your mind on doing it. And Zazen is very useful in that regard. That's all.
So the next question that we have is, what does joyful effort feel like? I basically like my life, but I'm not aware of feeling joyful. Maybe I'm thinking it will be something more expressive, whereas I'm pretty matter-of-fact, basic, everyday life person.
Joyful effort has an aspect of cleanness to it. There's something that needs to be done, and you do it directly, mindfully, deliberately, without rushing. Then you do the next thing that needs to be done in exactly the same way. It's not cheerleading, but afterwards there's no leftover. There's no baggage. And it's the baggage that creates inertia. It gets heavier and heavier. So your question is, what does joyful effort feel like? It feels clean. It feels really clean. You can definitely feel that. That's my answer.
The next question is, I think I've confused rest with wasting time. What exactly is the difference?
Rest is nourishing to the body, mind, and spirit. But when we rest, that's all. We need to just do that. When we rest, that's all we do. So you lie on the floor and maybe close your eyes, and that's the end of it. You don't multitask. So it's a singled featured activity, and it's extremely nourishing. It's just like pouring vitamins into your body. The things you do to waste time actually drain you of energy. They drain the life force out of you, and it builds toxicity, giving you more baggage, making joyful effort harder. So they actually flow in exactly the opposite direction. I hope that's clear. They flow in exactly the opposite direction. One is nourishing and one is draining. So try to do the nourishing one, which is single-minded rest without distraction. And even though your mind is racing, that's not going to, if you're just, you know, lying there, that's not considered a distraction. That's all.
Thank you, Gail. So somebody shared, I find doing anything single-mindedly difficult. I always want to do something else also. Like I'm always multitasking and feel guilty when I just do one thing at a time. It actually feels like I'm wasting time.
I know. But deep rest, lying on the floor on your back, it could be on your bed and then on your back, for 10 minutes can change the whole tone of your nervous system. Really, even 10 minutes. Our minds, I found this really hard to believe when I first learned about it. Tibetan Buddhism just has this on every other line practically. Our minds cannot think more than one thought at a time. I know we think like, it feels like we're thinking more than one thought at a time, but these people who do nothing but examine these kind of things all day long, every day, say that our minds can only think one thing, one thought at a time. So essentially, you're avoiding your life by multitasking. It's not like I know you feel like if you don't do two things at a time, you're wasting time. But the real truth is, since your mind cannot have two thoughts at a time, you're not actually doing two things at a time. And by trying, you're also not doing one thing at a time, which is entering your life fully, minute by minute. And so you're wasting your life. You're living on the surface. And it's really a pity. It's really a pity. Try hard. And I think this rest, taking rest, will help you a lot. I know someone who, she's actually teaching classes in rest. online, and it's been enormously useful to her students. That's all.
Thank you, Gail. So the last comment that we have is, the only joyful moments I know are watching Netflix.
So that numbed state of mind is like being on drugs, and only you can get off of them. But you can ask for help. You can ask for help. Ultimately, again, your life is your responsibility. But with great compassion for yourself, you must take firm steps to get your life back. I keep saying this, but Zazen really does help. It really does help. I wonder if you should take a diet from Netflix altogether, because Netflix doesn't help. It just keeps urging you, you know, right? I mean, if you don't make an effort to stop it, it'll just go on to the next thing. So it's like a drug that keeps giving itself to you, and you have to force it to stop. Anyway, the bad news is that we need to do it. We need to do it. If that is the last question, then I would like to thank Sahar and Brian and Brendan, who work very hard to make these teachings possible. I thank them very much, and I thank you for attending, and I'll see you next week.